Now, if you want to crown them, then crown their ass. But they are who we thought they were, and we let them off the hook.
Thanks, Coach.
Welcome to another edition of Jedi and Germs on the Jazz, a weekly podcast brought to you by TornbySports.com. I'm Alan Zog, the Jedi. He's John English, the Germs guy. Hello, John.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great.
Yes. And we had a good time, Jedi and Germs, at the Golden State game last night. We had a good time.
We were there live.
Yes, we were. Too bad we didn't, you know, record any snippets or conversation or nuggets or whatever. I don't know. We didn't do that, but we had plenty to say during the game and plenty to say, you know, as it progressed towards the end of the game. So I'm assuming you want to start off with talking about last night. So let's address the game last night. What are your initial thoughts on the game?
Well, I did a write up at Torn by Sports about my recap of the game. I thought the Jazz gave it everything they had, and I thought it was the toughest test for the Warriors to date. Overtime game in there, but when I look at that game, I don't know what was going on with them that night. But the Warriors are just so dang good that even against what the Jazz can throw at them, they were just always there to make the right play at the right time. And it really came down to that last possession when Rodney Hood missed that three. And I rewound like five times to watch how Draymond Green got that rebound. And there's no real good answer for it. I mean, Rudy's hands were on it first, but Draymond just dove through it with such force that he was going to be going out of bounds with the ball, and he was able to have the wherewithal to turn around to Curry. That wound up being the game right there. But, you know, the Jazz were just that close. And, you know, the Warriors, the big question was what's going to happen first, the Warriors lose or the Sixers win? And the answer is the Sixers win.
Yes. And they did it tonight against the woefully horrible LA Lakers. So, I agree with you. I mean, watching last night, I'm even looking at that last play, and there's been a lot of people who have really, I wouldn't say torn to shreds, but have really critiqued and broken down that play with Rodney Hood. A lot of people fault him for what took place. And I saw some quotes that Aaron Falk put out there from Coach Quinn, Hayward, and Hood about the situation. That final play, do you remember how much time was on the clock when that inbound went in?
9 seconds.
It was 9 seconds, okay. So with 9 seconds to go.
Oh, inbound, it was like 15 seconds, and he shot it around nine.
Okay. For some reason, I kept thinking it was closer to 6.5, 7. But even then, seconds.
I'm getting this all wrong because the Jazz only had 2.4 seconds left when they got the ball back. So,
yeah.
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 He shot it early enough that it was giving them enough time to recover, but they needed to get the rebound to do it.
And here's a couple of observations based on both post-game remarks by Coach and also by what we saw. You and I were talking about this before the play even got off, and I looked at you and what was the question I asked during the timeout? I asked you a question, and what was that question and what was your response?
It was something like, who do you want to take the last shot or who gets it?
Right.
And my number one was Hayward, and my number two was Burke's drive and kick to Favors at the top of the key. Of the five guys on the floor, I think Hood was the fourth guy they would have picked to actually take the shot.
Agreed. And my response to you on that was, yes, if I had to pick two guys two guys to close out that game last night. In my opinion, it's the two best closers on the Utah Jazz team, and that's Gordon Hayward and Alec Burks. So if I'm Coach Quinn in that timeout, I'm calling a play one for Hayward, which is what he did. I mean, it was a play for Hayward, and Hayward admitted afterwards that he slipped on it. And the Warriors played denial on Hayward too. Hayward didn't get a clean look to get a pass. But my thought is, if that's your last timeout and you're going to use it, then call the play for Hayward, but let's call a backup plan while we're at it. Say when Hayward's not there, when Hayward's not available, let's run it let's have our second option be Alec Burks, which is really funny because Alec Burks, I don't know if you remember the play exactly, and you rewatched it a few times. I seem to remember Alec Burks being the guy who ran around the pick first, ran around Rudy Gobert first. He didn't get the ball because they were running him as a, what's the word I'm looking for here? To draw the defense away, and then the ball went to Rodney Hood. So I think that he was a decoy initially. Am I right?
Well, Quinn said the play was initially going to be for Hayward, but Warriors denied it. And whatever play the Jazz draw up, the Warriors are going to have their own defensive assignments.
Right.
And it was clear from their defensive assignments that they did not want Hayward to be the guy with the ball in his hands.
Exactly.
And they played really close on Burks. They kind of funneled the ball back to Hood.
Okay, so
they wanted to make sure that Burks couldn't slash and that Hayward just wouldn't get the ball under any circumstances.
All right, and that's kind of what I saw, and I wanted clarification from you on the matter. That's what I got the grasp of. That's how good the Warriors defensively are. I felt like that final play was completely dictated by what the Warriors wanted, and they wanted the ball in Hood's hands. Not that that's a bad thing, because Hood has hit shots like that, and I don't have a problem with him taking that shot. Was it a little early? Could he have passed it off? You know, I had somebody mention to me today that Favors was open over the middle heading to the basket. You could have got him a dunk or a layup at the basket or a foul. I won't disagree with that, but I don't have a problem. I don't see a problem with the way the play took place either. I don't have a problem with Hood with that option.
Well, we've seen Hood hit big shots in the past, but Locke pointed out that Hood has not made a shot in the last 3 minutes of a close game yet this season, which was a really weird, interesting stat to me. And Hood at that point was 4 of 11 in the game. So you could argue that he wasn't having one of his better shooting nights, and therefore you could see why the Warriors would rather have Hood have the ball over Hayward or Favors or Burks.
Right. And let's not forget, too, you and I talked about this. Hayward and Burks were the two hottest players in the fourth quarter for the Jazz up to that point.
Yep.
So, no, I couldn't agree more. And if you're writing up schemes to defend the Jazz, take out Burks and take out Hayward in the fourth quarter, and you have yourself a chance to win. And that's just how it is. You know, having Exum in the game, if he were playing and in the game, might have changed that landscape a little bit. But I'm not sure I'm comfortable with Exum doing much in that final few seconds of the game either. It really, when it comes to the Jazz, defending the Jazz in the fourth quarter is defend Burks and defend Hayward, take the ball away from him and funnel it to somebody else, and you give yourself a chance to win the ballgame, period.
Well, I think a lot of people would be just as happy, if not happier, with Hood taking the shot than Exum.
I would.
I know I would. I would take Hood over Exum, and I'm a huge fan of Dante and what he brings to the game. But the guy I almost wish had taken the shot was Favors.
Right.
Because you saw third quarter, Favors was putting the team on his back. I don't know that I've ever seen Derek play with that kind of passion. And he just seems to have it this year. And I absolutely love it.
The one thing I will say observation-wise from Favors' game in the fourth quarter, it looked like his legs were going. And the reason why I say this is because through three quarters, and I looked at John in the fourth quarter and said this after his second miss, I told you, you know, and John, I don't know if you remember this, but Favors had been hitting that free throw line extended shot for the first three quarters. That 15-footer free throw line extended on the right side a little bit was open for him all game long, and he was nailing it every time. You got to the fourth quarter, he missed three in a row from that spot. And to me, that's legs. To me, you've been running, you've been going up and down with this Warriors team. You're in the fourth quarter now. that's legs right there, because you, as a big man, as any player, you have to have legs on that shot. And I don't know if he would have had it for a jump shot at that point in time, which is why you've got to try and work it inside if that's the way it is.
Well, Alan, as a former player, you know, someone who played in rec basketball as a child.
Here we go.
I can tell you that when the game is on the line, legs have nothing to do with it. It is all heart. And Derek has heart, my friend.
Somebody get me a shovel.
And there was like a minute and a half in the fourth where he took Derek out of the game and then put him back in. And it seemed to be just for that, just to get him a little bit rest.
Agreed. So I do like that pick and pop with Favors. It's starting to look really good. I don't know. Did you notice they went to that a lot though last night? That pick and pop for him was money.
Yeah, he hit it like the first four times.
Yeah. And that's a good shot for him. That's a great shot. I mean, that's, you know, and the more he gets comfortable with that shot and the more he works it around the world a little bit, drops down on those baselines with some of those fadeaways right in that same type of spot, that's going to be a dangerous position for teams guarding Derek Favors, because now you know you can't leave him alone 15 to 18 feet out, because if you do, he's going to kill you. So if you guard him, and now he's going to go at you. Derek Favors this year is making leaps and bounds, I think, above what he has, and I think is solidifying himself as a top power forward in the NBA. Has to be.
Yeah.
So, so the Warriors, let's talk about them for a minute. They're that good. Is that our assessment? They are really that good.
They are that good. I mean, they didn't have Harrison Barnes last night. Of course, Jazz don't have Dante Exum. But they are so deep, and they managed to make themselves deep with players that just weren't working on other teams.
Ian Clark, Brandon
Rush.
I mean,
when we had Ian Clark and Brandon Rush, they didn't do anything. But they go to the Warriors.
Right? You remember what Downright Dave Horan said at halftime about it? I don't know if you were right there. Maybe it was after the game he said it.
I think it was after the game, and I took off. So I just said hi to him and yeah. Took off.
He looks at me and he goes, what does that say about the Warriors? Brandon Rush was horrible on the Jazz, and now the Warriors are good with Brandon Rush. I don't know if I'm quoting that right, but that's just funny.
I tweeted at halftime that if Ian Clark shot the way he did in Utah than he was for the Warriors, Jazz would have had the lead at halftime.
That's true.
And let's be honest, you look at Brandon Rush, I mean, the guy looks like he's dropped a few pounds.
Probably.
And, you know, maybe that's just because he did so much sitting when he was with the Jazz, but the guy looks a lot better. He looks like the guy I think everyone hoped he would be when the Jazz traded for him.
Maybe winning a championship while riding the pine last year made him realize maybe he could work hard and contribute.
Yeah, maybe he cut back on the Krispy Kremes. I don't know what he did, but he looks better.
Well, I mean, Brandon Rush never wanted to, and he was here during a Ty Corbin year. But I just felt like the entire year he was just counting down until his contract was up and he could get out of Utah. He just seemed to be miserable the whole time he was here. And he couldn't wait to get back to the Warriors, and they were happy to take him back. And, you know, he spent a year on the Warrior bench, and now he's actually gotten himself into shape and has a better attitude where he can contribute. But yeah, now he's playing like the player we were hoping we were getting.
And I think he hit the nail on the head. It was a bad attitude. I put him right in that same class with Rajah Bell the second time around and Cantor as guys who just had a bad attitude and
probably,
yeah, made the team worse by being on it. I don't think he did anything to better the team while he was here.
Just sit on the bench and pout, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, I would have been just as happy if the Jazz had traded him away for nothing or, you know, did what they did with Rajah and just said, you know what, just don't even bother showing up.
I will say this. I'm extremely happy for a guy like Ian Clark, though.
Absolutely.
He was a fun player to have around the Jazz organization for the bit of time he was here. And it is really nice to see him contribute on such a good team, a championship team. I mean, last night watching him, I don't care if we were all just cursing those corner threes during the first half. It doesn't matter. It was Ian Clark, and you saw him having fun and shooting the ball. You couldn't be happier for the guy, even if he was shooting him from the corners there and unguarded all four times. We had plenty of curses to throw in the direction of the Jazz team for that. I know John did. John looked at me. He's like, man, can the Jazz guard a corner three?
I know. They hit like three corner threes in a row.
Yeah, well, and what's funny is...
And you're like, call a timeout and tell them to guard the corner three.
Well, and what's funny is all three of those were Ian Clark. He hit two from the one corner, and then you come back down the other end, and he switches to the other corner and nails another one. It's like, really? Come on, guys. First of all, it's Ian Clark. Second of all, corner three, guys. Corner three. And it's the Warriors, and it was... I think it was David Locke that said this. I mean, you're talking about a team... Isn't it fascinating that you can put Ian Clark on it and everybody shoots good, Ian Clark included? They're all shooting over 40% from downtown. That's just when you're having fun and you're hitting shots. I mean, what the heck, you know? Just do it. Have fun.
Well, that is, I think that's like what you see with LeBron. You put LeBron on a team, and everyone on that team suddenly becomes better. And I say it's the same thing with Steph, because you have to double Curry when he's got a shot. It doesn't matter if he's 5 feet behind the three-point line. You give him any airspace off of a screen, he's going to make you pay.
Absolutely.
And that is going to free up guys like Clark, who, you know, if you're playing the Jazz and Clark's on the floor, he's just another guy. He's going to be guarded. But you have to leave someone open when you're playing against Curry, and you've got Clay. I mean, they've got shooters.
Yeah.
Someone's got to be open on the wing.
Well, and I'll tell you this too, watching the way the Jazz defended, you know, Steph Curry's special. I don't think anybody's going to deny that. I think we're all in agreement on that. Watching the way the Jazz defended him for three quarters last night, it was great. I mean, the Jazz were physical with him, and what I even liked more is on the offensive end, or on the defensive end, if you will, the Jazz made Curry work defensively. Because there were times when Curry was guarding Hayward. There were times when he was guarding Burks. And, well, he had to guard him, which I think translated to a tougher time for him to get going on the offensive end. And then the fourth quarter rolled around, and forget it, 6 of 24 through three quarters, it doesn't matter at that point in time. He went off in the fourth quarter, and he came up big like big players do. John, I would have to think, though, that the Warriors are dead in the water if Steph Curry goes down with an injury. I just don't think they're the caliber of team that they are right now without Steph.
Well, he is the best player in the NBA right now. And when I look at – I was just looking at their games, plus minuses in those games, and I see the Warriors as still a playoff team without Steph, because they have a lot of talent on that team. But, you know, you swap Steph and another really good player on another team, and that other team is now undefeated or 17-2 or something. And that other good player you put on the Warriors are still probably, you know, 14-5 or something. But Steph is really, he's just the best player on the planet right now. And so
I agree.
He just always makes him better. I mean, when Steph was off the floor, the Jazz were plus +9 on him, I think.
Yeah, and they played well. I have to disagree with you slightly, because I actually think there's only one player in the NBA that makes every team automatically better when he's on him. I don't know if Steph – Steph, I think, can do that, but how much vastly better does he make each team? I think if you put Steph on Philly – I don't know that they're 17-2, but or on the Lakers, I don't think they're 17-2.
No, but he said if you put him on a good
team. Right.
Let's just, for example, let's run a couple situations here.
The reason why I say that, if you put LeBron on Philly or LeBron on the Lakers, I think he makes them vastly better. LeBron is the type of player you can put on a bad team, and it makes them almost playoff worthy. Steph, you've got to put him on a good team, and he makes him better. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And that's Tony Jones was saying this, was having a conversation with somebody like this on Twitter today, and I couldn't agree more with what he said, and that is LeBron is the only player in the NBA you can put on any one of the 31 teams in the NBA, and they are a playoff team almost automatically. Steph is the kind of player that, yes, they're a championship-caliber team the minute you put them on a good team. Poor teams, I don't know if that's going to do much.
Okay, so let's just say you take Chris Paul and swap him with Steph.
Oh, they're two. Yeah, the Clippers are vastly better already.
Okay.
Can you imagine that, too? Can you imagine that? J.J. Redick, a pure shooter like that, and Steph Curry, a pure shooter. Suddenly, you've already made yourself a better shooting team by adding Steph. But now, add the dynamics of shooting on that club, because you've already got a guy like J.J. Redick that can hit anything. You've got other guys that can. That's incredible.
Okay, what about Oklahoma City?
Oh yeah, you could swap out Westbrook and Curry and put Westbrook on the Golden State. And while it keeps Golden State a playoff team, no, I think right there Steph might give Durant a chance to win a championship.
Now let's go to Portland. Let's say you take Dame out and replace him with Curry. Where is Portland in that situation,
John?
I think Portland's back in the playoff mix. You put Curry on that team.
Okay, not championship caliber, but definitely in the playoff picture.
Yeah, but see, I don't think you can make – LeBron doesn't put all 30 teams championship caliber.
No, but I don't – but that's not the point I was making either. That's not the point I'm making. But look at what he did. I mean, just out of – look at what he did with Cleveland last year. Cleveland was what the year before they brought in LeBron?
Oh, yeah, Cleveland was a 60-win team with him. He leaves. They instantly become one of the worst teams in the NBA. They remain one of the worst teams in the NBA the entire time LeBron's gone. He comes back, and they're in the finals
and just a game away from winning him. So,
although, to be fair, when he came back, he also made them trade for Kevin Love. So
I agree.
It was really a LeBron and Love coming to Cleveland.
I agree with that, except that Love was non-existent for quite a bit of last year. Specifically the playoffs.
Yeah, the playoffs, but he was responsible for a lot of their regular season success. Even if people say that they didn't like his role or whatever, but I'm just kind of scrolling through here. When they really put it together, it was around January, it seems like, that last year when they got things figured out. I'm trying to get back to the Cleveland page from 2014-15. Let's see. Take me back to Love. I want Love's numbers.
We all want Love.
Give me some Love.
Okay, there he is. Okay, Love played 75 games. So he wasn't out that much in the regular season, and he was giving him 16.4 points and 9.7 rebounds.
But here's what I'm throwing at you. Go back to that 20-game stretch in January where LeBron didn't play. How well did the Cavs do? I mean, granted, we're having to break that down by games here. But the other thing I'm looking at, too, is it's also in the East. And, again, that's a variable that can go both ways. I agree.
You know, I think people give way too much credit, and I'm probably going to get called out for saying this, but that Love makes all this difference. You have to remember that if Cleveland does not trade for Love, they've got a guy who's pretty good at basketball in Andrew Wiggins.
That's true.
I still think that the Love trade was absolutely terrible for Cleveland. I think it was extremely short-sighted, and I don't think it makes them that much better in the East. I think they could have picked up a free agent or a trade for someone who maybe doesn't have the star power, you know, maybe doesn't have the reputation for being an all-star, for putting up the kind of numbers, but could be a real contributor in a LeBron system. I mean, think about what Tristan Thompson did last year in the finals.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Did they really need Love, or would they have been better off giving Thompson more minutes and keeping Wiggins? I would have kept Wiggins. That's me, though.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Valid point. I want to throw another name into the mix before we change topics, though. Last person. We mentioned Steph. We mentioned LeBron. Let's go Kevin Durant. What does Kevin Durant do for other teams when he's on them? How much better are other teams?
We'll find out next year.
Say he's a Laker next year. How much better are the Lakers with him on it?
As long as the Lakers get rid of Byron Scott, the Lakers are going to be much better no matter who.
Playoff contenders?
They sign.
With
who
Durant?
Who they sign. But with Durant, yes. With Durant and any other coach, playoff contenders.
Okay.
You'll have Randall in his third year, Russell in his second year, Clarkson in his third year.
Right.
You add a veteran who isn't shooting 7 of 26 every night, then yeah.
And so that's where I ask, where does Durant rank on that list? I mean, we're talking about Steph and LeBron making 31 other teams better. Where does Durant fit on that list? Does he make every team marginally better when he's on them? That just like that. So I mean, you're talking.
Well, okay. Now you're saying any team better? Of course, the top 40 players in the NBA make every team better by being on that team.
But I'm talking within the context of where we went with LeBron and Curry.
Yeah, I think Durant is that big of an impact change because he is such a good scorer. I mean, he's held the scoring title 4 times. He's the GOAT.
Well, let's think about this. Durant is a small forward, correct?
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's switch him out for Carmelo.
Uh-huh.
Knicks, a lot better. I think you would say they are a threat in the East.
Top 4 or 5 team in the East. Yeah.
Okay. Bring it.
And not just because of his talent, but because of his mentality.
Yeah.
Bring him to Utah. Switch him out for Hayward. And I'd be curious what people think about this. So if you know any of our listeners want to chime in on Twitter, let us know. But if you take Durant and do a trade and he comes to Utah, Hayward leaves, Jazz a contender?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good point. Well, with Rudy Gobert and Derek Favors in the front court. That entire front court, that's Durant, Favors, and Rudy Gobert. That's a very long and very talented front court. Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know, just throwing out some thoughts, talking about some of the players. Yeah, what we witnessed last night, I mean, this just goes back to what we witnessed last night. I mean, Steph is special. Steph is very, I mean, Steph's incredible. You know, Derek Favors, a hand in his face, guarding a 35-foot shot like a guard could, and Steph draining it, tying up the ball game at 99. I mean, you couldn't ask much more defensively on a play like that. So
I wanted to go back to one more thing about Cleveland.
Okay.
Love missed 7 games last year and the Cavs were 3-4 in those games. LeBron missed 13 games last year and the Cavs were 3-10.
Ouch. Says something to LeBron. I'm just that really solidifies what I was saying about LeBron. It really does.
Hey, do you have the games pulled up? Who they lost to when Love was out?
Yeah. Let
me I see where you're going with page. This. You want to see what kind of impact as a player he made in those types of games.
Who they lost to?
Yeah, who did the Cavs lose to when Love
they
was
lost
out?
To Milwaukee, Chicago, Miami. Boston.
Milwaukee might be the odd duck in that group because the other three teams.
Well, this was before the Milwaukee trade last year when Milwaukee was playing really good, when Jason Kidd was suddenly looking like coach of the year.
Right.
Yeah, the Milwaukee game is one they should have had, and the Boston game is probably one they should have
had. Yeah.
Chicago, I can see them dropping that one even with Love in it. Miami, was it away at Miami? Do you know?
No, it was a home game.
Yeah, see, that's one they really should have had.
I see where you're going with that. You want to see what impact off the floor and on the floor it is for Love and in certain matchups. And, no, I agree.
I'm just curious if they lost to the Sixers during that time because, you know, that would be saying something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So,
well, I can go back and look at the LeBron ones.
No, LeBron's the greatest. we don't need to talk about that.
You just said 3-10. Really matter. You just said 3-10 when he was gone. I don't think anything more needs to be said than that, John. Yeah. So any more thoughts on last night's game?
So close. So very close.
And it's really annoying that we always have about 800 people with brand new jerseys of the other team's star players acting like they've been fans the whole time.
Bandwagons. Bandwagon
Total
fans.
Total bandwagons. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon. I swear, there were so many Steph Curry jerseys, and they all look brand new.
Yeah.
They all look like this was the first time they were being worn.
And I talked to a...
Pretty amazing.
I was talking to a friend last night who actually said she approached... Lauren Brown, it was. She said she approached one of the fans that was wearing a jersey and asked him about it. And he openly admitted to the fact that he was from L.A. and that he normally cheers on the Lakers, but he was wearing a Steph Curry jersey. That about covers it right there.
That is exactly what I figured was happening with most of the people there.
Can you blame them, though? I mean, I completely think that you should cheer for the Jazz because it just makes sense. But I'm a fan of any team that LeBron is on, and people can say what they want about that, just because it's so much fun to watch him play and to see the impact on the team. I think about when he and Wade were playing together those first couple years, it was phenomenal to watch, and it was a blast. And I can look at the Warriors. I do not like the Warriors. I will put that out there. I am not a fan. I can respect their talent, and I can see why people would get into it, though. It's fun to win. And Curry is a hell of a ball player.
Yeah.
You know, I can't be like, yeah, you shouldn't cheer for them. Now, you know, the Lakers thing, that's different. But I don't know. I don't like being the fan police for things like this. If people want to be a bandwagon fan, that's great. Just openly admit it and be like, hey, these guys are good. I enjoy watching them. It is what it is.
And I will say this, bandwagon fans are not. I gotta think that the people that were there watching went to that game for one reason, to watch Steph Curry and to watch Golden State. Granted, most of them are antagonists against Utah Jazz fans because they just are. You know, most of them, if they are Laker fan, Heat fans, whatever they are, they probably enjoy getting under skin of Jazz fans because historically it's been a known fact that folks, as much as we are the best arena or have been the best arena in the NBA before and a very rabid fan base, I think that's what other fans enjoy, and when they know that about them, they're going to do their best to get under the skin. So you have it two ways there. They want to see Steph Curry play, and they want to get under Jazz fan skins, and guess what, it works. It was working. So,
well, as the March Hare once said, I have an excellent idea. Let's change the subject.
I'm all for it. What's up next?
This coming week, two more home games, got the Magic and the Pacers, and a week from now, Tuesday, they will be at Sacramento. All three of those are winnable games.
By the way, the Magic have won four in a row.
Yes, they have. But we will be getting the Magic at home, and despite their recent success, I still say they should win that game.
Can't disagree. Devin dropped his predictions early on this week, too. And if I remember correctly, he had him winning that game. In fact, I think he had him going 2-1 on this stretch.
No, I got stupid and I said they would go 3-0.
Oh, because you thought they'd win last night.
I said there was no reason they should beat Golden State, and that's exactly why they would. But the Magic, yeah, Magic are the worst team that the Jazz will face this week. You know, and after what happened in Orlando, the last game where Favors was in foul trouble and Rudy was out with an injury, I see this as the big revenge game. The Jazz want this one. How can you not want this one when you really lost a game you should have had on the road early?
Yep. No, I I agree. I think they should win Orlando. I think they should beat the Pacers as well. That's another game that features Gordon Hayward versus Paul George. But I think Gordon Hayward is starting to come on of late. I really do. The last two or three games he's been playing, he's really started to heat up and play well. Seems to be dropping back into his comfort zone on the court a little bit, which has been very pleasant to see. So I'm going to enjoy that matchup. And then Sacramento, well, dumpster fire. Jazz should win it. You're right. They should be 3-0 over the next three games.
Yeah, which of those do you think is most concerning? You more worried about Orlando or Indiana?
Pacers by far.
I would have to say the Pacers. And mostly because of just how Frank Vogel gets them to play. They're sound defensively. And yeah, Paul George is something to be worried about. So I have to think that might be a game you might, you know, if the Jazz let it slip past in the back of their mind a little bit, they could easily drop that one.
Have you seen how good the Pacers have been recently?
I have not.
Paul George is back to his all-star self. I mean, 27 points, 8 rebounds, 4.5 assists, 1.6 steals.
What's their record right now?
10-5, something like that.
That's a good
11-5. 11-5.
Yeah, they're second place in the East. At least they were.
Okay.
And I can't remember. I had it in the morning shoot around how many they had won over like the past 13 or something like that. 13 games or 10 games. They had only dropped like two. I mean, they've been hot.
Yeah,
they've
won.
One of the hottest teams in the NBA.
They have won 8 of their last 9.
So yes, that one does fit the mold of a team that were to worry.
Actually, they you know, Jazz already played them and beat them, and so Indiana started 0-3, and now they're 11-5. So they've gone 11-2 since the Jazz loss.
Yeah, that's impressive.
So Vogel's like figured some things out, and now they're playing much better.
Well, and again, it goes back to Vogel has been very good getting that team to play defensively. And that's the other thing you have to think about is they are a physical team, especially on the defensive end. And that's going to give the Jazz team, you know, the Jazz trouble, especially if they can't play, you know, the style of offense Quinn would like them to do regularly. If they can, I think they'll be fine. But the Pacers are another team that can dictate the pace of a game with their defense.
I see what you did there.
Maybe. But it's true, though. John, tell me I'm wrong.
You're not wrong about how they can pace a game.
yeah, Devin, I did go there, and so did John.
was George Hill out when the Jazz played him?
No.
No, he had his Cisco haircut going, and, you know, I remember seeing that on the
court. Oh, you're right.
And he was
trying to figure out what the difference is.
He was actually one of the bright spots in that game, if I remember correctly, too. And that's not speaking of his hair alone. No, I think overall, I think he had played really well in that game. He was one of the positive strings for them offensively. If I remember correctly, I'd have to go back and look at the box score, but I thought he was one that played particularly well in that game. But which is not surprising, another backcourt player playing well against the Jazz backcourt.
Well, that's one thing the Jazz really have to watch out for when they play Indiana, because Indiana's top three scorers are also all shooting 42% or better from three.
George Hill?
I mean, George is 45, George Hill, Paul George is 45, George Hill is 42, and CJ Miles is 43.
CJ Miles, another former Jazz man that's just killing it from downtown.
Yeah, but you never know. Once he comes back to the Viv, he may turn into his old self.
Maybe. But CJ's a guy, too, that Jazz fans, I don't know that there's a Jazz fan that boos him. We all love him. He was a guy that we all loved. regardless of the criticism he got, he was a guy who embedded himself in this community, and people enjoyed him, and people enjoyed seeing, you know, supporting him.
No, he was a good guy, but you got to admit he was kind of streaky.
Yes, he was.
And when he was down, he still, you know, shooters got to shoot, right?
He was definitely a shooter's got to shoot guy.
Yes, he was.
I remember thinking that time that he scored 40 for the Jazz kind of killed his career here, because after that he thought he was the next Kobe and just started shooting awful and wouldn't stop. And I think that was just kind of
the end for him.
Wait, you mean seven? You mean
he
seven
was
for
the next Kobe?
You
you're
mean
right.
7 for 26 is not good? Oh, my bad. Sorry, Kobe.
Okay, careful.
Can I just say that? I don't know. It's a little obnoxious that Kobe's announcing his retirement this early, but he's still going to play the whole year. I mean, you know, most NBA players don't announce a full year before they're going to retire that they're going to retire.
Usually by All-Star break, you see him start to pop the, I'm on my last leg.
Yeah, but this must be a Laker thing, because Kareem took a full year to retire and got gifts everywhere he went. Now Kobe looks like he's going to do the same thing. He's going to do the year-long celebration of me before I retire thing.
Let me ask you this. Do you think how poorly he has played has anything to do with it?
Yeah.
To get a different type of reception. This is I know I'm struggling. Please don't boo me. I'm going to be done after this. This is the last time you're going to see me, so you better say thank you for all the times that you made me hate. You hated me.
Yes and no. I do very much think that his play is contributing to his decision to retire.
But this early?
Well, yeah, I don't know.
If he was shooting 45%, he would not have announced his retirement.
Yeah.
If he was shooting 45%, he probably wouldn't retire, let's be honest.
I will say this much.
Exactly.
He chose right before a game. You know, look at where he was tonight. He was in front of his hometown crowd, in front of the folks he grew up around, and got a chance to play one last time. So there might have been some thinking around that as well. Who knows?
I'm just curious what will happen, because we had talked about this, I don't know, a month or two ago, I think. And I had said that I'm not fully convinced that Kobe's going to hold up through the entire season. I would not be surprised if he ends his career injured. And I'm not saying I wish that upon him or anything like that. I'm just saying he's had so many injuries over the past few years that I can see that happening. But you've got Upper Bowl Laker tickets. I think it was the Jazz game, the last game of his career, going for like $600, I thought I saw.
Well,
can you imagine buying those tickets and then he's out with an injury?
Yeah.
Because it's very possible that could happen.
I will say this much, though.
Yeah.
With the work ethic he has put in his career, with the guy that, I mean, he puts in extra time, he works hard. If anybody understands his body, it's definitely, I mean, he definitely knows when his body's saying, you know what, I can't go anymore. And I don't know if you guys read, he did a nice piece for, again, the Players Tribune, where he spoke about that very thing, where his mind and his mental state, he wants to keep going, but he understands, his body is just breaking down and there's that time. And it's unfortunate he couldn't do it when he was on top, but it's also unfortunate for him that the last 2 years he sat out because of injury. So you throw all that into the mix, and it's a mixture of just what else can he do? I go back to it, though. I agree, taking the entire year, it just must be a Laker thing, maybe. But you know, I don't know.
Well, I've gotten the feeling this whole dreadful season anyway that he knew they weren't going to win, and so he was just going to try to score as many points as possible to, you know, add to his career total. I don't remember where he is on the all-time scoring list. Isn't he fourth or fifth?
Something like that. No, third.
Kobe's third.
Okay,
third. Is he third now?
But he's still okay. So far behind Malone and Wilt that I don't think so he's going to catch.
He did
Kareem,
pass.
I mean, Kareem. He's so far behind Malone and Kareem, I don't think he's going to catch either one of them.
He won't catch him this year.
Yeah, and the way he's shooting, he has no chance. I also heard he's also the all-time leader for most missed shots. And he's going to rack that up.
Right about now is where I insert Homer Simpson. Dope!
You know, his PER is 9.9. He's shooting 30% from the floor. Now that he's announced his retirement, it makes it a little more palpable why he's taking so many shots. Before he announced his retirement, your thought was maybe I don't know what his motivation would have been before he announced his retirement. But now that it's clear that, yeah, this is his last year. And I understand his mentality. I read his poem and it was nice. And he is that driven. His work ethic is that good. And it must kill him that he just physically can't do it anymore. And yet he still takes all those shots, giving his team no chance to win because he's, you know, mentally he's still the star. Mentally he's still the all-star, but physically he's just not anymore. And he's not doing those things to help his team win. And yet I don't put the blame mainly on him. I just think their coach is so inept that
right.
It doesn't really matter. And it's actually good for the franchise for him to just keep shooting terribly so they can keep their first round pick this summer.
Well, and I think back to what you said a minute ago, his mental makeup, he is still a star and he's still it. And I was listening to, and I forget the guy's name, but it was on NBC Sports. It was Amani Toomer and what's his name on the night show on NBC on my way in and to do the show tonight. And they had Mike Breen on and we're talking about it too. Kobe's mental makeup is very similar to what Jordan's was. Neither one of those guys, they both understand that it was a breakdown time. It was time, but neither one of them have that makeup to where they're going to say, all right, I'll accept a role like Tim Duncan does. I'll accept a lesser role on the team, a lesser money and all of this in order for the team to win. That's not their mentality. It never was. Jordan wasn't going to do that. Are you kidding me? Jordan, when he played, even when he was in Washington, he wanted to be the man, and he wasn't going to be that guy that would play 20 minutes a game and allow the younger guys to get better and improve in his absence. And Kobe's the same way. He's not going to, and it's just his mental makeup. And it you're right. It's better for the Lakers at this point that he continues because they're going to be there in the lottery. They've got no other option but there to look right now.
The difference, however, is that Jordan was a better player in his final year. He was 39 in his final year. Kobe's 36 now. Jordan didn't have as many injuries as Kobe has, but he was still playing near the top of his game. He was 20 points a game, 6 rebounds, 3.8 assists, he was shooting 45%.
Jordan also didn't have as many miles on his body at that point in time either because he took a 2-year break to play baseball. He also didn't start in the NBA as a high schooler. He started as a, what was he, a junior out of college?
Junior.
At that
time. He was 21. Yeah. He was 21 his rookie year.
So,
yeah.
So Kobe's got 2 more years alone in the NBA from when he was, you know, in high school. And then you add on to that again that Jordan took a 2-year break to play baseball. So he doesn't have the miles on him. He didn't have the miles on him that Kobe does now either.
Yeah, but you have to realize that Jordan, during his time off, was going up against the best players in the galaxy when he played the Monstars.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
Wow, this conversation.
We can't overlook that.
This conversation just went downhill. Wow. All right. Next topic.
I don't have a lot as far as rapid fire questions today, but I wanted to bring it up because what we saw yesterday, Draymond Green. I saw that Jerry West was saying that Draymond Green is a top 10 player in the NBA. And a lot of people saying, one person was doing a poll on Twitter. I'm sorry, I don't remember who it was. Who would you take, Rudy or Draymond? And I'm curious what you guys think, because I have my opinion, which I think I've been pretty vocal about in the past. But John, Draymond Green, is he as good as everyone likes to say he is? Is it a product of, you know, is it a Curry effect, kind of like what we were talking about earlier? What are your thoughts on him?
I don't think he's a top 10 player. It's hard to say. It's hard to say if you put Draymond on another team, how he would do. Like Curry, you know that team's going to be drastically better no matter which one it is. You put Draymond in another system, how good will he really be? Now, he's been an incredible player for the Warriors. I mean, he's turned into a scorer, an outside shooter, a rebound. He's really good at passing. He's turning himself into a really versatile player. He's actually pretty similar to Kawhi now, the way his game's developing. He's probably top 25 player right now.
Alan, what are your thoughts?
I mean,
I can't disagree with anything John said. I think he's right. It's sad. I've never been a Draymond Green fan. I just haven't. In fact, I'm a bigger fan of, you know, what Iggy brought to that team than I am Draymond Green. Because Iggy offensively was a guy who was a starter in the league for so many years, comes in, takes a bench role, but puts up, you know, wonders, fantastic, fascinating, whatever it is, minutes on both the offensive and defensive end, and contributes in such a way for the Warriors. I thought, in fact, I dare say in the finals run, I thought Iggy was much more vital to the success of the Warriors against the Cleveland Cavaliers than Draymond Green was. So, do I think Draymond Green's a good player? Yeah. Do I think he is that vastly better than it? You know, I might go with John and say maybe he's a Kawhi Leonard type of player. I don't know. For me, the verdict is still out. I like I said, I was not a big fan of him early on, and I still will stand by the statement that I thought that I still think that the Iggy has been more vital to that team overall, for their overall success over the last year, than I think Draymond Green was. And that's saying a lot, considering they paid out money for him, for Draymond, and considering what everybody else, the experts, called Draymond Green to that team. But I still, Iggy's my guy, really.
Okay, let me ask you this. All-star voting comes up, and let's say you've got Favors not in the all-star game. And we all know how well Derek's been playing this year. Is Draymond going to be in before Favors would be in?
Yeah, I think he would.
Do you want my emotional thought on that, or do you want the facts? I mean, the truth is Draymond Green probably will be. If I would choose emotionally, I think Favors should be. If I were to choose as a pure fan, I would rather have Favors in there, but yeah, unfortunately, because of where the cards lay right now, yeah, Draymond's probably going to be there before Favors.
See, and
I think Steph, Clay, and Draymond are all stars this year.
And see, I think Favors should be as well. So,
yeah, I mean, their numbers are pretty similar, except Draymond got 7 assists a game.
Yeah. But Favors,
and he shoots from outside, but yeah.
But Favors leads power forwards in steals.
And let's be honest, John, it's pretty easy to get assists when you're throwing the ball to Clay and Steph. I mean,
that's true. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's actually kind of weird to compare these two. Because there are some stats where Favors is so much better, and there are other stats where Draymond's better, and it's right. Just like, well,
yeah,
I don't know. Draymond's it's just so versatile that so Favors scores more than Draymond, he rebounds a little bit more than Draymond, he gets more steals, Draymond has this huge assist advantage. Draymond can shoot the three. Blocks are pretty close, actually.
But steals. Gosh, but steals.
I know. Two steals a game. Favors is still two steals a game.
You know what's crazy? The Jazz have had two power forwards over the last 5 years that have averaged two steals per game. Can you name the other one not named Favors?
Millsap?
Yeah. Millsap was a guy that was averaging two a game for the Jazz.
He was a really good steal man.
Yep, there's something to be said about Jazz big man, the power forward, averaging two steals a game. That's pretty impressive.
Malone was a good steal man.
Yes,
too.
He was. Yes, he was.
Okay, guys, we're starting this. Hashtag Steel Lake City.
Steel Lake City.
Oh, Devin just had to make sure that he got the rights to that immediately. You heard it first on Jedi and Germs.
Steel Lake City.
Jody, we love you, but Devin's getting tabs on that one before anybody else can. So Jody, we're assuming you'll hear this. Don't take it from him.
Jody, if he wants to fight over it, he can come on the podcast and we'll talk about it.
Hey, where do you think the Jazz rank in steals?
Top 15.
Top 5.
They're fourth.
Ooh, nice call, Devin. Nice call.
You know who's third, though?
The Warriors.
Indiana.
Who?
Indiana.
Oh.
I got to watch for that.
Yes. The Jazz are very good at taking care of the ball, though. And, oh, by the way, that's another stat that goes out last night. On their way home, I heard them throwing stats across the radio. The Jazz had 18 assists. Not great. Good. But they only had 8 turnovers against the Warriors last night. That's pretty good.
That is good for them. They're not that great for turnovers. Let's see. They are, what are they, 12th, 13th, somewhere in there?
Middle of the pack.
7, 9, 11, 13, 14. They're 14th in the league in turnovers.
And really, that's because of one or two games where they were 20-plus, because Jazz have done pretty well early on taking care of the ball. But they had, what, two games, one of them being that Oklahoma City game, where they had, like, 21, 22 turnovers.
Yeah, their average is 14.9. The best team at controlling their turnovers is Charlotte with 12.6, and the worst is, well, it's the Sixers, of course. And they're at 18.8. So that's really only a 6, you know, 12 to 18. That's all 30 team range.
I think
so Jazz are right in the middle on that.
I think John's got a phrase that is part of his like standard greetings now. It's the Sixers, of course.
It's the Sixers, of course.
Well, hey, let's touch on any pop culture. We're looking at, you know, approaching the hour here. So,
wow, Devin jumping in and taking the reins of this, grabbing it, putting the leash on it, saying, come on back.
Wow. Alan's slowing it down by pointing it out.
Wow. Yes. Thank you.
So John, pop culture. Have you seen anything?
Thank you, John.
I'm watching Jessica Jones on Netflix. Are you guys watching that?
I have not yet. It has been added to my list.
It's really good. It's the same universe that Daredevil exists in. Well, they all try to say they're in the same universe. So you're vaguely aware that there are Avengers out there and so forth. But this one deals with an ex-superhero who's had a really traumatic experience. And it's basically one long season-long mystery as to how she's going to defeat the Purple Man. And the Purple Man is a villain who can control your mind. So it's really difficult to fight this guy because, you know, if you get in the same room with him, he'll just take over your mind and make you do things you don't want to do. And it's a really interesting, different take on what the superhero genre can do.
So it's like dating.
Well, she's like an ex superhero. She now doesn't want to be a superhero. She goes by her regular name. And
no, sorry, Devin. He went right past you on that. He's not even given that a chance, dude.
Okay.
So it's like. I heard him right. What did you say?
He says, so it's like dating.
Yeah, the mind control. Oh. And.
Well, yeah, they actually do have a history of dating. So
see?
I've heard Jessica Jones is very dark, though.
It is dark.
Okay.
If you were cool with the darkness of Daredevil, it goes a darker shade than that. There's a big reveal on exactly what he did to. It's like she is already damaged from this thing that this villain did to her a year ago, and she thinks he's dead. And so the first episode, she finds out suddenly that he's still alive, and that freaks her out. So you go a few episodes before you learn exactly all the damaging things he did to her and how that's warped her sense, and you find out just how evil he is. And
all right.
I don't give it away, even though it's all there on Netflix.
I'm looking forward to watching it. I binge-watched Daredevil a few months back all at once. It was great, so I'll have to do the same thing with Jessica Jones.
I'll also say that now that we're in December, all the critic circles are starting to do their top 10 lists and movies. The first one every year is National Board of Review. They do theirs on December 1st, and they declared that Mad Max Fury Road was the best picture of the year.
Not surprising. It came out with rave reviews, so it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, I'm happy. I hope it actually gets a Best Picture nominee, and that is not the type of movie that usually does get awards.
Right. While we're on the subject of movies, I did go see The Good Dinosaur over the weekend.
Oh, is that good?
It was. I wanted to sleep. I can't say it was horrible. It wasn't. It was different. It was very different from a Disney Pixar film. I'll say this much though: that it had the feels about it. Like my daughter, my 15-year-old daughter, at the end of the movie, she was getting up and I looked over at her and she'd been crying. So it was definitely. It had the feels. It had the. It got her tear jerking. And let me tell you what kind of a feat that is for a movie to get my 15-year-old daughter to cry like that. It's got to be that kind of a movie. And it worked. It worked for her. It was actually really good for that aspect. It had all the makings for a really nice family tale. I don't know. I preferred Inside Out early on in the year a lot more than I did this from Pixar. I wouldn't put this near the top for Pixar. I didn't think it was bad though. It was decent.
Your daughter's really hoping that she doesn't have any friends to listen to the show, Alan.
Probably.
I heard that one. It didn't have a lot of like comic relief. Is that correct?
No, it did not have very much comic relief. That is correct.
That's surprising to me, just because that seems to be something that Disney and Pixar have done so well on, is having that little bit of, you know, laughter to kind of pull you through the movies, even when there's, you know, emotional things happening.
There was a lot of emotional, deep emotional connectivity through the movie, though. It was very focused on relationships, family relationships. You know, Dinosaur loses his father early on. And then you've got Dinosaur meets Human, which Human almost represents the dog for the dinosaur. It's like the dinosaurs are the ones that are speaking and have the dialogue. And the human boy is the one that's like acting like a dog, you know, pat, you know, tongue wagging, all that kind of stuff. So it had that relationship, that dynamic between the dinosaur and the human boy was actually really good. It was family like as well, but I don't know. It didn't really get me like other movies have. So I would say it's one of those you could wait and watch on Blu-ray or DVD, rent it. It's not something you have to go see in the theater.
Yeah, it looked like a lesser Pixar effort. Just didn't have the same buzz around it as Inside Out and other good ones. It looked to me more like a Brave level Pixar effort.
And I would actually say that I thought Brave was better than The Good Dinosaur. So.
Okay.
So there you have it. Devin, do you have something to contribute? You're always watching, you know, new experiences for you, old films.
Didn't watch any movies this week. I watched the fall finale of Gotham last night, and that was quite enjoyable. I found I really like the show. I really like this whole concept of the backstory to Bruce Wayne, you know, to the city of Gotham, and kind of having a different look at things that we've known for years. It's just intriguing to me. So, I don't know. I'd recommend people, you know, if you're a Batman fan, I'd give it a shot and get caught up. And then I think it's starting up again in February. So.
But cool. I'm enjoying it. I'm like three episodes behind, but yeah, it's a good show.
And last but not least, we are 15 days away. By the time everybody listens to this show, 15 days away. And if you don't know me, then you don't know what 15 days means.
Christmas is 24 days? 23 days?
Devin, don't try.
Yeah.
You're failing, Devin.
15 days until Alvin and the Chipmunks 4 opens.
No!
Alvin!
Yes, Alvin.
It's the road chip, which is just the worst pun title ever.
Yep. All right. Well, let's wrap it up tonight then. We want to thank you all for listening. Check us out on iTunes and Stitcher, Jedi and Germs on the Jazz. Leave us reviews on iTunes. We would love reviews. They're helpful in getting us noticed and ranked in iTunes for podcasts. Also, you can find us on Twitter at Jedi and Germs. Always the sneaky, ever the very smart intern that runs that particular. And John, I'll just tell you, I get lots of comments back that people still think it's me tweeting from that account. It's not.
It's not you?
No. No. Wait, oh. What? Don't act surprised. Don't even. So, but yes, it's a wonderful intern. Takes care of things. We've almost fired him a few times, but he's there. Then you can find John on Twitter at germsguy, myself at Jedi Zog, and our ever exciting, talented producer, Torn by Devin on Twitter. Thank you, Devin, as always, for putting together a good show. So thank you all for listening. Find us on Facebook at Jedi and Germs on the Jazz, and we'll look for us next week. Thank you, everybody. Have a good one. John, take us out.
Bye, everybody.